Authors, writers, dreamers, all. Each day is an invitation to accept the call. I'm Brooke Warner from She Writes.
And I'm Grant Faulkner from NaNoWriMo. You're listening to Right Minded, weekly inspiration for writers. Hello, superheroic writers. I'm Grant Faulkner, and welcome to another episode of Right Minded. I'm here with the superheroic Brooke Warner, and we're going to do a special episode today. You know, one great way to develop your superpowers as a writer is to read and study writing books or how to write books. And, you know, when I was first starting out as a writer, I'm going to date myself here, it seems like there were only like a handful of writing books out there, and I cherished every one of them. But now there are literally thousands of them on every topic under the sun and then some. So Brooke and I thought it'd be great to kind of bring in some of our favorites and read some excerpts and discuss them a bit. And we hope they'll resonate with you. So Brooke, do you want to kick things off? Did you bring in some of your favorite books?
I did bring in some, and I am sure that some of the ones that we chose are going to be other people's favorites, and hopefully it will remind you of how much you loved some of these if you have read them. And then if you haven't, we hope that you'll go out and get them and read them. A lot of the writing books that I love are the ones that are kind of the writing life kinds of books. The thing that resonates most for me when I read writing books is when someone can capture how I feel about the practice of writing or what it feels like to be in that energy of being a writer. And it's hard. And I like it when people acknowledge that, you know, not that it always has to be difficult, but certainly that putting yourself out in this way and saying that you're going to write involves a lot of layered details of difficulty, because there's stuff like, you know, self-exposure. Are you actually good enough? The craft, the time involved. And so I'm kicking off with Annie Lamott and Bird by Bird, yeah. Which is a classic.
Yeah. You know what? That was written about the year NaNoWriMo was founded, I believe, or published. And it's amazing how so many of her words are also our words. You know, we were kind of thinking the same thing at the same time.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's, 1995 is what it says.
Oh, it's before us. We were 1999.
Yeah. So, and absolutely. I mean, I think that this is a pretty epic book and one that most people have read, but I thought it would be fun to just share a little bit about the book to say that it is this notion that, you know, the only way to move forward is just bird by bird. She shares a little story in the book that her dad shares this with her brother when he's struggling on some project. And it's an analogy that goes throughout the book. And she's both very encouraging, but also, as people who know Annie Lamott's work, you know, she's got a lot of tough love in here as well. And so I wanted to just share two small excerpts. One is about getting started. And this is from the chapter called Getting Started. And it says, "But how?" my students ask. "How do you actually do it?" "You sit down," I say. "You try to sit down at approximately the same time every day. This is how you train your unconscious to kick in for you creatively. So you sit down at, say, 9 every morning or 10 every night. You put a piece of paper in the typewriter, or you turn on your computer and you bring up the right file, and then you stare at it for an hour or so. You begin rocking just a little at first, and then you look at the ceiling over and over and you yawn and stare at the paper again." And she goes on and on. And it's quite funny, because I think what she's doing there, of course, is capturing the difficulty of really sitting down to write, and that it's not always as productive as you might hope.
Exactly. I love how she gets into those small granular details, but for a writer, all of those details just resonate so much.
Right. And then the second passage I chose is because of how famous the shitty first drafts are. And this came from Annie. And almost everyone I know uses that term, and it comes from this book. And she writes, "Now, practically even better news than that of short assignments is the idea of shitty first drafts. All good writers write them. This is how they end up with good second drafts and terrific third drafts. People tend to look at successful writers, writers who are getting their books published and maybe even doing well financially, and think that they sit down at their desks every morning feeling like $1 million, feeling great about who they are and how much talent they have and what a great story they have to tell. that they take in a few deep breaths, push back their sleeves, roll their necks a few times to get all the cricks out, and dive in, typing fully formed passages as fast as a court reporter. But this is just the fantasy of the uninitiated. And she goes on. So it's very, as I said, encouraging, I think. And I hope that everybody who has read this book will revisit it. To me, it kind of busts a lot of myths and helps you feel better about your writing process and teaches you something about patience.
Yeah, that's basically the NaNoWriMo about page that you just read.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I love Annie Lamott. And I love what you said as an intro to these books. You know, when I was sitting down and choosing some of my favorites to bring in today, what I realized is, you know, I'm always reading. I like to always have like a writing book on hand that I'm reading. And what I realized is that I should go back and reread a lot of my favorites because they're just so fresh and wonderful, just like Annie Lamott, who I probably read, I don't know, 20 years ago. And the one that I'm going to read from now is similar. And everything you said is it's nice when you find a book and you get not only a taste of a writer's life, but a deep drink of it. And Stephen King's On Writing, I think, is you know, an equal classic to Annie Lamott's. And one thing I like about it is that, you know, you think about a writer like Stephen King, who writes mainly horror. And I think a lot of people would think, oh, well, Stephen King, if you're not writing in that genre, he might not have anything to say to help me. And what I love about Stephen King's On Writing is I know writers in every different genre who've read it and loved it. So he obviously did something really wonderful. And two things I like about it is one, he, like Annie Lamott, he really gets into his writing process, and he writes 2,000 words a day, at least, every day of the year. He's unapologetic. He writes on Christmas. He writes on his birthday. He doesn't view it as work. He says work is when you're not writing. That's when he finds it difficult. So he's got a lot on developing that discipline and that routine that's really valuable. But the thing I like the most as someone who is like a really poor plotter or challenged plotter, put it that way, is you'd think that Stephen King, he's so prolific, he has very plot-driven novels, yet he doesn't outline a plot beforehand. He doesn't think too much about plot. And for me, when I read this, he gave me, he allowed me to release my hangups on plot, you know, like I gave them up and just sort of accepted who I was as a writer, and it's worked out better as a result. So I'll read this bit about what he says about plotting, and I got to find my place here. He says, I distrust plot for two reasons. First, because our lives are largely plotless, even when you add in all our reasonable precautions and careful planning. And second, because I believe plotting and the spontaneity of real creation aren't compatible. It's best that I be as clear about this as I can. I want you to understand that my basic belief about the making of stories is that they pretty much make themselves. The job of the writer is to give them a place to grow and to transcribe them, of course. And then he gets into this wonderful metaphor about how stories are found things like fossils in the ground. And it's our job as writers to excavate them and bring them out of the soil and then bring them to life. And one thing he said about plots was that he doesn't think of this kind of, I don't know, action-oriented plot. He thinks of just characters going into situations. They go into a situation, they deal with it, and then they exit changed. And that's like my favorite way to think about plot.
Thanks for sharing that, Grant. I know that that is such a beloved book, and it is amazing to hear advice from people like Stephen King who really live and breathe their craft and who have so much deep experience. The next one that I chose for today is probably not as well known, clearly, as Annie Lamott or Stephen King, but this book called Book Life by Jeff Vandermeer, which is from 2009. And when I first read it, I just felt like he was speaking my language. The subtitle is Strategies and Survival Tips for the 21st Century Writer. And while he does have a lot of advice in here about writing, it actually is mostly about the writing life. And I'm going to read a not too long of an excerpt, but one that honestly really changed my life when I was beginning to blog and do social media, because it's called Managing Open Channels. And I think so many writers struggle with how much time and energy to dedicate to their various social media platforms and other things. And so that's what he's talking about here. And I think it would be helpful for other people as it has been for me. He writes, I'm clearly not the only one to think about such issues, by which he means blogging, social media, etc., in relation to creativity and career. When I wrote about white and dark noise on my blog, my good friends Dan and Tessa, both writers who move effortlessly through new media, shared some interesting and extremely sobering thoughts on the subject. Dan sees noise as coming from everywhere, and it has an element of randomness to it. White noise, he writes, comes from channels you open or allow to be opened. And this is the theory that I thought was so profound. It says, I have experienced an overload of what you call dark noise. It was followed by a depression, actually. Instead of the dark noise metaphor, though, I've thought of it as having a finite ability to handle a limited number of open channels. Mostly the idea of a channel centers around a communication medium. A blog one writes, a site where one participates in comment threads regularly, an email account, a collaboration on a project. But a channel could be any relationship, really, though I think particularly an online one, because the other side of the channel is not feeding back into you directly, if at all. One thing that's tricky is that the channel stays open in your consciousness even when you're not paying attention to it. In fact, that you're not paying attention to it at any given moment creates an extra stress. I've started training myself to be careful of opening new channels. And online, I found myself becoming more of a passive consumer of online channels that don't know I'm listening. Connected to this topic for me was an overload of too much attention spent in the virtual world of the internet and also mass media in general, particularly TV. The real world became foreign to me, and that took a toll. And so it's powerful, right? And I share it with people because I started to think about all the things I was doing as channels, right? My own social media, my blogging, the columns that I was writing, the email that I was attending to. And I realized that what he said, this notion that not attending to it creates stress, was so true for me. And so this book is full of all kinds of insights like this. But if you are a person who could use some support in your book life, I highly recommend this book. And it was a book that for me helped me to understand that there was a difference between my book life, you know, which is like the platform that you're creating around who you are and what you want to be doing with your writing, and my private life, which needed tending to in its own right.
Yeah, I loved that, the way he described that. It actually reminded me of the Annie Lamott description, because he got so into the specifics of it. And I bet we've all had that feeling of being overwhelmed by channels. And it's the title of the book too, it really is about being a 21st century writer. And I think we all, we're all conflicted or overwhelmed and looking for solutions. And the thing that also like resonated with me is that, you know, I think the deeper thinking, the deeper that you can go into yourself as a writer, the better that your writing is going to be. And so I feel like with all that kind of being overwhelmed by so many channels, it doesn't allow me to go deep into myself and do deep work. I think that's the title of another sort of internet book, but very interesting. I actually have I think this book was written pre-internet. And I like the way, Brooke, that you kind of have categorized books, like books that are about the writing life. Because I do think they're kind of like subgenres in these writing books. They're books about the writing life. They're books that to me are almost like poetic or religious. And that's the one that I'm going to read from, Annie Dillard, The Writing Life. And then there are other ones that are more about like how to write suspense, or how to write dialogue, or how to write a blockbuster. And I have to say, maybe I should read more of those books, but I haven't found those to be as helpful. I always wonder if you're writing a how to write a blockbuster book, why you just don't write a blockbuster, I guess.
Right. Or why more people don't write blockbusters.
After you read that book, they should be everywhere. So this one comes from Annie Dillard, who wrote The Writing Life. And I put this in the category of these books that just, it's about the writing life, but she writes with such a poetic and almost religious sensibility about it. And that's where I find nourishment, I guess. And I view Rainier Maria Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, which I'm not going to read from, but I brought. It's very similar. And his book, they were literally letters to a young poet who asked him for advice. And he wrote about 100 pages worth of letters. And they're wonderful. But this is Annie Dillard. And this is like how the book begins. It's similar to Annie Dillard, or Annie Lamott's, actually. When you write, you lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a wood carver's gouge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it and it digs a path you follow. Soon you find yourself deep in new territory. Is it a dead end, or have you located the real subject? You'll know tomorrow, or this time next year. You make the path boldly and follow it fearfully. You go where the path leads. At the end of the path, you find a box canyon. You hammer out reports, dispatch bulletins. The writing has changed in your hands, and in a twinkling, from an expression of your notions to an epistemological tool. The new place interests you because it is not clear. You attend. In your humility, you lay down the words carefully, watching all the angles. Now the earlier writing looks soft and careless. Process is nothing. Erase your tracks. The path is not the work. I hope your tracks have grown over. I hope birds ate the crumbs. I hope you will toss it all and not look back. And she keeps writing with different metaphors and kind of spinning them out. And I just find it just an amazingly poetic approach to exploring the nature of writing.
That's beautiful. And the thing I really like about these writing life books, and I think I prefer them over craft books too, although a lot of them sprinkle craft into them, is this sense of comfort in the camaraderie of the process.
Yeah.
That someone articulates exactly what you feel and what you know to be true. And sometimes we just need to have that reflected back to us.
I think that's exactly right. I think these writing books, oftentimes, I think that's why they're less about craft to me. It's more about feeling the community of another writer.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that one. And then I chose The Art of Memoir, of course, by Mary Carr. And for any memoirist, but I honestly think anyone who writes personal anything should read this book, because there's so much about writing the truth and about self-exposure and about the nature of truth in general, which is really at the heart of this, like what is truth and how do we think about truth? And then it also really addresses the hard work of writing memoir, because as I've said before on this podcast, all writing stretches you. But there's something very unique about putting your own truth on the page and how deeply self-exposing that is beyond even just the prose. Like, do I write well? Can I tell a good story? Then layer on top of that, oh, and by the way, this really happened to me. It's hard. And so in the preface to the book, Mary writes, in some ways, writing a memoir is knocking yourself out with your own fist if it's done right. And I love that way of talking about it because it's so true. And she says, no matter how self-aware you are, memoir wrenches at your insides precisely because it makes you battle with your very self, your neat analyses and tidy excuses. And so she's just acknowledging what it feels like to write a memoir. And and there's a lot of craft in this book. So I recommend it again, like for craft as well. But I think she has some great passages here about all kinds of things. And as I said, including truth. And so this is the second and final passage I want to read when she's talking about how to talk about truth. And she says, however often the airwaves wind up clotted with false memories and misidentified criminal culprits and folks dithering about what they recall, I still think a screw has come loose in our culture around notions of truth. A word you almost can't set down without quotes around it anymore. Sometimes it strikes me that even when we know something's true, it's almost rude to say so, as if claiming a truth at all, what? Threatens someone else's experience. Most of all, no one wants to sound like some self-satisfied proselytizer everyone can pounce upon and debunk. The American religion, so far as there is one anymore, seems to be doubt. Whoever believes the least wins, because he'll never be found wrong. It's odd that I've never seen a televised minute about the simple rules of veracity the nonfiction writers I know seem to cleave to, murdering themselves in revision after revision, trying to meet it. This overlooks the reality. Am I the only person left alive to believe this? That most memoirists know the past can be a swamp. Nonetheless, most of us are trying to find footing on more solid ground. Some memories, often the best and the worst, burn inside of us for lifetimes, florid, unforgettable, demanding to be set down.
Interesting. That's almost a metaphor similar to, it's different, but it's similar to the Stephen King finding a fossil and bringing it up out of the ground.
Yeah. And also she's talking about the fact, and I think this is true for fiction and nonfiction writers, that some writers, and probably many of our listeners really feel this to be true, can't not write. You know, mm-hmm. I use intentionally that double negative. Like, it's burning inside of you. You will write, because if you try not to, if you try to ignore it, there is this kind of burning, as she said, demanding to be set down. And I know countless people who feel that way. They try to go away from their writing and they come back. And I think especially sometimes with memoir, when there's a story really needing to be told, the writer has a hard time escaping it.
Yeah. I was talking with a writer recently, and we each confess that the days we don't write, we're just super cranky.
And yeah.
I think that that's what happens when you're not bringing that story out. You just, it festers inside you and actually makes you cranky. And that's, we decided that that was a perfectly good reason to write, just to reduce your crankiness, that you're a better person in the world. You make the world a better place just by being less cranky.
That, and I think what it shows is that you guys have a life practice, you know, something that is akin to spirituality or meditation or exercise, you know, whatever that thing is that you do to calm your nerves, that is part of your identity, that's part of your everyday. And I think that's really something to embrace.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I chose one. This is a little bit different one, but I love this series of books. They're published by Grey Wolf, and they have a whole series called The Art Of. And so they'll have books like The Art of Intimacy, The Art of Mystery, The Art of Subtext. I think they're 20 or 25 books or so. They're all really slender. They're sort of like super long or long essays. And they're all very, I don't know, just very, very thoughtful, very poetic. And the one that I brought today is one of my favorites. It's by one of my favorite poets, Dean Young. It's called The Art of Recklessness. And Dean is a kind of, you know, very kind of wacky, surrealist poet. You never know what to expect from his poems, word to word, line to line. This book reads as a sort of manifesto, you know, and it's a beautiful manifesto. I think it's just so affirming for artists. And even though he's an MFA professor, I think he writes a lot of this as a sort of riposte to MFA programs. And so the passage I'm going to read is kind of him taking, you know, poetry classes curriculum to task. And so he says, "To approach the practice of poetry as an acquiring of skill sets may provide the stability of a curriculum, but the source of inspiration is as much instability, recklessness. Poets are excellent students of blizzards and salt and broken statuary, but they are always elsewhere for the test. Any intention in the writing of poetry beyond the most basic aim to make a poem, of engaging the materials, should be disappointed. If the poet does not have the chutzpah to jeopardize habituated assumptions and practices, what will be produced will be sleep without a dream, a copy of a copy of a copy. The poem always intends otherwise. At every moment, the poet must be ready to abandon any prior intention in welcome expectation of what the poem is beginning to signal. More than intending, the poet attends to the conspiracy of words as it reveals itself as a poem, to its murmurs of radiant content that may be encouraged to shout, to its muffled musics there to be discovered and conducted." And yeah, he just, this whole book is just this amazing riff. He has these great quotes. Let me see if I can find this other one.
It's just gorgeous prose. I mean, just listening to you read, it's like, wow, it's clearly written by a poet.
Yeah. He has like, "Art initiates, irritates us into plentitude. It makes the world and our consciousness more." That's where I think it's almost religious. This is essentially, this distills it all, I think. He kind of yells out, "The writing of poetry is not a craft." And then this is the line I love: "We are making birds, not bird cages."
Hmm.
And I think that sums up the book, all about the making of birds. And I think Dean is the only one who could have written this book. And that's why I love it.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for sharing that one. I haven't read it, and I really look forward to, because it's such profound insights and beautiful language. So Grant, I thought we might close by sharing not passages or necessarily even explanations of why we love these books, but maybe three or four other titles that we have nearby that we just want to give a shout out to. I put a little stack together. So do you have three or four that you want to share?
Yeah, you know, when we were talking about the classification of these writing books, I think like Dean's book, The Art of Recklessness, is all about, you know, seizing on the liberty and the freedom of your thoughts and the power of those thoughts. And I think there are a number of books that relate to that, like freeing yourself up. And one, of course, is the classic, The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, which includes her famous morning pages, which I love. Basically, she says, just wake up in the morning and write for 2 pages, write anything. Don't let your pen leave the paper. It's all about exercising your inner demons. And I think Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg is also very similar. And the reason I mention these, of course, is because that's what we espouse at NaNoWriMo. So I'll include Chris Beatty's No Plot, No Problem, which is basically the NaNoWriMo Bible.
Awesome.
How about you, Brooke?
Yeah, I have a handful of books here that are by people I know. And so I just want to give a shout out to them, people I've worked with or know in some capacity. And so another one, Journey of Memoir by Linda Joy Myers, that she is a co-teacher. We teach our memoir classes together. And it's just a really, really helpful handbook for writers of memoir. So I recommend it highly. I recommend You Should Really Write a Book by Regina Brooks, who is an agent in New York, who I really admire and like a lot. And I like the way she writes. And there's also incredible book recommendations in this book, which I think is kind of fun and you don't see too often. Sin and Syntax, I have to recommend, is a classic. And I know you and I both know Connie Hale. But if you want to read a book about language, there is just no better book. And I think all writers should take themselves to task, or rather give themselves that challenge of writing a book about language and syntax. You might find that it's more interesting than you might have thought. And finally, Grant, I'm going to shout out your book, Pep Talks for Writers, because I love it. It's fun. You guys all get the treat of hearing Grant's Pep Talks live when we do these podcasts. But do yourself the favor of buying the book.
Thanks so much, Brooke. And there are many, many more. So maybe we'll dabble in some writing advice from these books in another episode.
Yeah. And if you guys like today's show, let us know. We're experimenting with doing some of these topical shows, and we'll take suggestions for topics that we might tackle, and share with us your own favorite writing books. We know that there are countless, and we'd love to hear from you on any social media channel. Please remember that this is a weekly podcast. You can get Right Minded on Apple, Spotify, anywhere where you download your podcast. And as always, we're still asking for those reviews because it gets us the visibility we're hoping for to reach new listeners. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.